Hello, hello, everybody. Stephen Molyneux with James Delmore. Now, it's one of these guys, you email me, or you set up this meeting to have this debate about Iraq, which I really appreciate. It should be a very good conversation. And I'm like, dang it, I know that name. I know that name. And so I looked you up and you're like a dude, like you've been on Fox News and all of that. So would you like to just start off by telling ye old audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, first off, thanks for having me and look forward to talking about Iran. I worked at Fox News for many years as a researcher and a news analyst. But since 2021, I've been in mostly crypto. I saw Bitcoin and everything else is changing the world, blockchain. So I've been working in crypto and blockchain since 2021 and mostly that. And then, you know, on the side, occasionally giving my opinion about things. And as a libertarian, I wanted to jump into the Iran war situation and give my opinion. I could be wrong, who knows, but I thought I'd throw it out there and chat with you about it. And I appreciate everything you do. So
fantastic. Yeah. And it's actually nice to take a break from talking about crypto to talk about something even less volatile, like international wars, because Lord knows crypto has been quite exciting lately, as it will continue to be over the course of my remaining years and your even more remaining years.
Yeah, I think it'll be a downturn for a little while, but it'll eventually come back.
Yeah. Okay, so I had a debate years ago with Dr. Block about spanking, and it was a very good debate, very honorable and very informative, I think, on both sides. And love Dr. Block. Of course, massive condolences recently about his family news. Just wanted to pass that out. If anybody wants to email him with condolences, I'm sure it would be greatly appreciated. And I did read with great interest your libertarian argument in favor of the war, I don't know, invasion, it's really hard to say, but the war against Iran. So if you wanted to run over the major points, we can see where we overlap, where we disagree, and go from there.
Absolutely. And I know it's a controversial view, and I'm open to hearing everybody's opinion, but this is just the one I came to, and him and I together were working on this together and made the argument. But yeah, I see that. And, regardless of whatever Trump's view is or Vance's or whoever's view is, we put forward the argument that Iran doesn't have sovereignty at this point. The Iranian government, excuse me. And so therefore, it's illegal war in terms of international law. But ultimately, we really focused on the Iranian people. 90 million people are literally living under a totalitarian dictatorship right now. And what is really the only way to liberate them? The UN isn't doing it. And they tried an uprising. They did in January, and they've tried them before, and they haven't worked. Many people have gotten killed. And the US is in a position where it can at least do something. And really, we're only in favor of intervening, whatever you want to call it, a war or, you know, trying to hold the Iranian government accountable, as long as civilian deaths are low, US military deaths are low as well, but can remove the regime and hopefully put in place one that is protecting the rights of Iranians. As we know, the only legitimate government, or to an extent a government is legitimate, is that it exists to protect the rights of its citizens. And obviously the Iranian government isn't doing that. I don't know if you want to jump in, but this is just the general kind of view we took, and we based our arguments from there.
No, honestly, feel free to flesh them out, because this is not... neocon is such an insult, and I don't mean to call you guys in that vicinity, but my audience has not heard these kinds of arguments. And of course, where you and I would agree is that the Iranian regime is a monstrous, evil, theocratic, hellscape dictatorship. And of course, the Iranian people deserve freedom and liberty and human rights and so on. So we're certainly not going to have any disagreement about anything to do with that. So tell me a little bit more about the perspectives. It was a two-article series, and again, very, very well written and very well and persuasively argued. So what else would you say to shore up the position?
Sure. And thank you for the compliments. First, Iranian regime has no sovereignty. And secondly, the sovereignty begins at the individual level, as we both know and as your audience knows. There is no collective sovereignty. Each individual is their own sovereign individual. And again, to just going back to the government, to an extent that a government has any legitimacy whatsoever, it's to protect that sovereignty of the individual. So what we argue in the piece is that the U.S. is actually in an attempt, again, regardless of Trump's motives. I don't know what his motives are. I have no idea. And probably they're not the same as mine. I will grant that. But they are to protect the individual of the sovereign person. By the way, everybody in Iran has sovereignty, from the regular ordinary citizen, even the Ayatollah does. But I would argue the Ayatollah doesn't have it anymore because you lose your sovereignty when you violate another person's sovereignty. So they lose theirs and must be held, you know, to an extent accountable, or stop allowing we have to stop the loss of sovereignty or taking somebody's sovereignty away. And so we based it on Iran government has no sovereignty, or protection of the individual sovereign, the sovereignty of the individual. The UN has failed horribly, or really any international body, to uphold individual sovereignty or the individual rights of people, to prevent things like this from happening, from allowing the government to take them away from people, as we agreed, you know, it's a monstrous government. A mechanism to protect those rights. We argue strongly that it doesn't matter. Yes, typically within a country's borders, yes, you don't want to go in and violate their sovereignty as a government as best as possible. But we argue that, you know, sovereignty of individual doesn't end at the border. That, yes, it is within their borders, that they're not doing it to Iraqis or to Syrians or whatever. They are doing it to individual Iranians. But there has to be some mechanism in place to protect the Iranian sovereignty. And we argue that the U.S. government really is the only one. Europe's not doing anything either. We do respond to some of the criticisms of ours, and typically by libertarians, especially when it comes to it's not a constitutional war, it's unpopular, these sorts of things. And as we argued, we kind of went back to the Iraq War. It was a popular war when it first started, something like 70%, I think the Gallup poll we cited, of Americans supported the Iraq War in 2003. They wanted to invade and whatever, do whatever to Saddam Hussein. And secondly, the Senate and the Congress both voted overwhelmingly, I think well over 2/3, to approve authorization of the Iraq War. So yes, it's true that didn't happen in this case, but just because it happened in that one, still didn't make the Iraq War legitimate. Our final one was, okay, let's say the U.S. government isn't the one to kind of intervene and protect the individual rights of Iranians. The only other alternative kind of would be an uprising. And so we acknowledge that. And look, by the way, that's my preferred way. I wish the Iranians could do it, but it just, at this point, I don't know if they have the means to do it. And the death count, I think, is going to be far higher than if the U.S. was conducting the war. As we saw, we don't know how many people died back in January and whatever during the protests, or, you know, there's a lot of fog of war. Their internet's been off for a while. I don't know everything that's happened. Nobody does. But it's possible that tens of thousands of people were killed. And if that were, you know, if they kept trying to fight this uprising, tens and tens of thousands more could have died, if not more. I don't know. I do recognize that I've seen estimates of like 1,500 were killed in this war, or civilians potentially. We don't know exactly. There's still fog of war with the U.S.-Iran war. But yes, that's horrible. Obviously that is a horrific outcome of war. The argument we make is that it was less than what would have been if there had been an uprising. So I know that's a lot. Thanks for letting me get through all that. Hopefully it wasn't too much. And
My audience doesn't deal with the concept of too much. I have over 6,000 shows. There is no too much in this space. Okay.
All right.
So, areas where we agree, monstrous, evil, theocratic dictatorship. I have great sympathy. I have actually a personal history with Iranian people that I really like Iranians as a whole. So don't get me wrong. The intervention you're dangling in front of me has a lot of cleavage. It has a lot of sugar. It has some carbs, some chocolate chips, and it looks pretty delicious. And I kind of have to steel myself against the offering that you're provided. And I'm sort of tell you a couple of reasons why, and you can let me know if they make sense to you or how they go. But let me ask you this, because the article was written in April, and of course, a lot has happened since then. It's now late June 2026. Has anything changed in your mind about the sort of the process, the outcomes? Now they're working on a memorandum of understanding with a 30-60-day window. How do you feel it's gone as a whole, and how do you feel it's going to go looking forward?
Great question. Walter has written about it. He says, you know, even though it was, you know, it ended the way it did, he still said it was positive because they destroyed the Air Force, they destroyed the Navy, and they pushed back their nuclear arsenal, like to whatever extent, many years or whatever, degraded it at least. I tend to agree with that. Yes, ultimately, I wanted the ultimate outcome to be liberation for people. I'm not naive enough to think that that was actually going to happen, but at least there was an attempt to, or at least make it possible for the Iranians to have a better chance in fighting back. I have not fully read the 14-point plan. I'm still reading it. I don't even know if that's going to go through. We're still at the memorandum of understanding. Who knows what will happen between now and coming to a final deal. I disagree with the deal, ultimately. One thing that him and I have worked on, another article, by the way, should come out soon. Happy to send it to you and happy to come back on your show to chat about it, is the Strait of Hormuz. We spent a lot of time on that as an international waterway and a right of the entire world access to. And, you know, we shouldn't let Iran just kind of control it, like the Iranian government, specifically the theocratic, you know, Islamic one. So it blocks, say, world trade. So we focus a lot on that in the next one coming out. Again, happy to send it to you early. But I don't like how, again, from my understanding, and maybe you read the memorandum understanding more than me, it looks like Iran's just going to keep control of the Strait of Hormuz, which is a little shocking to me, especially because, first, things I've read is that there's countries around the world that aren't going to ship through the Strait of Hormuz anymore after this. They don't want to deal with the potential Iran blocking it. And one of the reasons I read where Iran was holding up getting the ships out is because once those ships get out, they're not going to come back. So they're kind of holding them up, trying to keep them in there, from what I've read. So I just feel at this point, we cannot allow a centralized, you know, talking about blockchain, one centralized control of a waterway like Iran has, so to just throttle international shipping for the entire world. So yeah, not a fan of the deal. Where I stand on it now, I support the attempt. I do think they kept civilian casualties low. You could disagree with me. And thankfully, only about 15, again, horrific. I'm not happy about it. 15 American soldiers died. I think it's 15 or maybe it's 20 now. I'm not sure. I read the recent numbers, but horrible. But I think in terms of comparing it to other wars, this was relatively low.
So it didn't achieve the goal of liberating the Iranians.
True. True.
Okay.
I can see.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry.
No, you were about to make a point. That's totally fine. What you got?
Oh, no, I can see that part. To me, it was at least an attempt to, you know, some have said, you know, in terms of Trump's, the reasons why he did it, or his motives, was that he said he would back those protesters, you know, back in January, and that if he didn't do something, he would have essentially gone back on his word. So, you know, it was at least an attempt to at least hold the people who committed those atrocities back in January accountable. True, it did not liberate them, but it, you know, they at least did hold some accountability.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate that. So my first thought, since I'm abstract philosophy guy, which hopefully has some value and utility, I like to think that physicists can also help engineers. So can you use NAP violations? Can you use violations of the non-aggression principle to defend against violations of the non-aggression principle? And it comes down, it's not the only thing, but the sort of the first place I start is, how's the war funded? The war is funded through what mechanism?
Through taxation. And I agree, it's coercive and it violates the non-aggression. I concede that to you.
Well, I mean, taxation would be an improvement because nobody's tax bill went up because of the war. How's it being funded?
Oh, debt. You're right.
Debt, it's being funded through debt and money printing, which is stealing from the young and the unborn and stealing from usually the poor, at least those most on the fixed income. The elderly and the poor tend to be the most hit by taxation. So that's a big question. If you say, well, you know, saving a great guy's life if he's dying of a kidney disease is really great. We say, yes, it's really good to save a guy's life who's dying of kidney disease. But that doesn't mean we get to go and, you know, kneel on a kid and take out his kidney with a spoon, right? Because that would be a violation of the non-aggression principle. So the great temptation, I think, of these kinds of things, we all want the Iranian people, as all oppressed people, to be free. It would bring some peace and stability to a very volatile region. It would mean that sanctions could be lifted. One of the things that breaks my heart outside of the pure moral elements, of course, is that the brilliance and genius of the Iranian people, historically great engineers, great artists, great poets, and so on, that's all under the boot heel of theocracy, and it robs the world as a whole. So again, we all want this, but what I noticed is that you and Dr. Block seemed a bit sneaky, could be wrong, seemed a bit sneaky. You did not address that. You say, well, it's very important to defend people from violations of the non-aggression principle. And the way that you're going to do it is to violate the non-aggression principle. Look, it's one thing if you would pass around a hat, right? And you were to say, hey, man, Iran is really cool. Look at these pictures of these lovely Iranian ladies before the revolution. We want to get back to that. And so, you know, donate and we're going to get some, I don't know, A-team military blah, blah, blah together. We're going to go and, okay, that's one thing. At least that's voluntary and is not a violation of the non-aggression principle. Running to the government, though, it's hard to say, well, it was really bad that that guy stole from you, so I'm going to steal someone else's stuff and give it back to you. Well, then you are both affirming and violating non-aggression principle and property rights and so on. So what's the response? Because that seems to me kind of insurmountable, but I could be wrong.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And I know Rothbard also made some similar argument many years ago. It's, about, you know, this like invalidates it. And I'd normally agree with you totally 100%. Here's where the pushback is at least this, I haven't looked into if there were private militaries or like you're mentioning, like voluntary organizations that were gathering to try and overthrow the government. And perhaps they were, you know, to the best of my understanding, the ones that have attempted to overthrow it have all been governments, like probably the CIA, Mossad. I don't know who. I'm sure intelligence agencies have tried to overthrow them for years. The argument would be, you know, it's hard to see getting those people together. I'm sure there are a lot of people, certainly in the United States, there are wealthy billionaires that probably do want to see Iran overthrown. And you could conceivably go to them and say, hey, we're going to get a private military together and we're going to overthrow the government, or we're going to, you know, fight back against them and uphold or help the uprising, if you will, in Iran or among the Iranian people against the government. I could conceive of it, but I just don't think it's happened. So I guess I might answer a question with a question, if you don't mind. It's just, would you support the war if it was, or do you think the war would have grounds if it was voluntary? Let's say the U.S. military is not involved or the Israeli military. It's just private civilians. Do you think that it would become an immoral war at that point?
Sure. I mean, because the Iranian government is brutally violating the sovereignty, free will, free speech, and private property rights of its citizens. So yeah, a third party self-defense is totally fine. If I see some little old lady getting beat up in a park, I can take out the robber and so on. So third party self-defense is totally fine. But running to the government, and I use running to the government, obviously a bit of a sophist trick there to make it diminished, but running to the government and expecting the government to solve or fix these problems, when it seems to me that libertarianism and Walter Block's anarcho-capitalism is in particular about, well, the government violates the non-aggression principle, and as a result, it's horrendous, immoral, and inefficient. And then saying, but here's something I really want, which is, and again, we all want it, and the devil doesn't come with things you don't want. The devil comes with things you do want. That's how he tempts you. And so, I would be fine with that. You said, of course, and you're right, that the Iranian government as it stands funds a lot of destabilizing stuff around the world. They fund radical terrorists and all of these kinds of things as well, for sure. But again, for me, I abstract and universalize. I mean, if we say, well, but destabilizing other societies around the world, well, that's really bad. Okay, well, which has done more? Just take the 20th century alone. We can go into 2003 if we want to do the Iraqi war. Which government has destabilized more countries, Iran or America?
I won't disagree with you. The U.S. I agree with you on that. Our arguments, though, just to be clear, are for this war. We're not arguing just for U.S. interventionism or, you know, destabilization in general, just in this context.
Yes. But then you have to say why this context, because I remember a very fierce Dr. Block railing against the Iraqi war way back in the day. I don't know how old you are. You look like not wearing glasses, so I assume you're quite a bit younger. Maybe you were knee-high to a grasshopper, or perhaps just a glimmer in your daddy's eye. But boy, Dr. Block was thundering from the mountaintop about how terrible the intervention in Iraq was. And it's a little, I mean, doesn't mean that we can't change our minds, doesn't mean that circumstances can be different, but I'm not sure it's overwhelmingly different.
Fair enough. I think, by the way, I was in high school during that war. In terms of the Iraq war, I don't know enough about Iraq. I know there was the battle, they invaded Kuwait, and they did rain down bombs on Israel at one point, or rockets, I mean, at some point in the early 90s. But I don't know if they were doing, they had been funding proxies the way Iran had, like violating the rights of Israelis. And I know there was in the 80s a ship did sink in, I think it was Lebanon. That I know there's debate over, was Iran ultimately responsible for the sinking of that ship, that submarine? I forget the name. I don't know if you remember.
Sorry, Iran
the name
or Iraq?
I'm talking about Iran. Oh, I switched it to Iran.
Okay,
I meant
sorry. Just that letter seems important to our conversation. So I just want to make sure I'm with you. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was making the argument that I don't think Iraq had, say, attacked the U.S. in the way Iran or U.S. allies in the case of Israel. Or there was some sinking of some ship, from what I'm familiar with, in the 80s. That some have attributed to Iran or Hezbollah or one of their proxies.
I mean, the general argument is that Saddam Hussein wanted Kuwait, if I remember rightly, was cross-drilling, was like diagonal drilling and taking oil that technically belonged to Iraq. And I think Iraq checked with the Americans and they said, yeah, do what you need to do to protect your oil. And then they used that as a pretext for a bit of a rug pull, a bit of a bait and switch. But it is, of course, a similar region, a similar situation, and so on. So it's a little hard to know how we go from outright condemnation to enthusiastic cheerleading without some sort of fundamental principle change, which we could certainly talk about. In general, how would you look at, from your high school days onwards, how would you look at America's invasions and nation building as a whole? How do you think it's gone?
Probably quite badly. People are talking now about how USAID is defunded, and now all of South America is going right wing.
I mean, Iraq, Afghanistan. Of course, the funding of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s to fight against the Soviets led sort of step by step to 9/11 and all of the catastrophic Patriot Act limitations of freedom and so on. And I don't know if you've seen this meme. It actually makes me feel better from time to time, where the meme is like, if you ever feel useless, it took America 20 years and $4 trillion to replace the Taliban with the Taliban in Afghanistan. And that's, of course, what's come before. Iraq, you know, whether it's a failed state or not, it sure as heck isn't a successful one. You've got sectarian violence all over the place, mass exodus. You have the revival of ISIS and the funding of ISIS. So the nation building has not been particularly ideal. And of course, this is the general argument which Block and others have made, which is that government programs lead to more government programs. America has been intervening in Iran since at least 1941 in a variety of ways. Will another intervention work? Will it fix it all? You could argue that one of the reasons why the mullahs took over in the 70s was because America was propping up and arming a fairly unpopular Shah and so on. So the concern is that the last government program justifies the next government program. You know, like, well, we have a welfare state. Now that we have a welfare state, well, you know, the family is broken up and therefore single moms need subsidized housing. Oh, but they're supposed to work, so now we've got to have government daycare. Like, one program leads to another. And of course, that generally tends to be the case. And so the sort of deep roots of this kind of stuff is important. It's kind of tough to look at, and this is, look, I love America. It's a wonderful country, beautiful people, and I respect a huge amount of the Constitution. America at home is a whole lot different from America abroad. I think we can both agree on that. And, you know, that old meme is like, why does the world keep building countries around our military bases? You know, like, you have all these, you know, what if they had 120 bioweapons labs all over the world and all of these military bases everywhere? I remember this is under Reagan. They said, well, they attacked the Marines in Beirut. It's like, well, why was there a military base in Beirut? Reagan was advised not to put the barracks there. And then later he admitted it was the wrong decision, but he'd already committed to it and so on. And so you'll notice that Iran is not targeting places like Switzerland. Iran is not targeting places like Iceland or Southern Ireland or whatever. And that's because they tend not to be quite as nakedly or at all imperialistic in this kind of way. So is some of the destabilization in the world and some of the hostility of countries in the world towards America the result of prior militarism, imperialism, and government programs, and therefore we're just continuing to play whack-a-mole with ever bigger walls, moles and ever bigger hammers because of prior interventions?
Yeah, and I'm not denying that that's the case. I think, post-World War II, but I mean, I don't think we should start it as, oh, the place would be the world. This would be the argument I would make. The world wasn't just peaceful, and then the U.S. came along and just destabilized everything. I do agree that, you can respond to that, by the way, if you want to jump in. But as far as just going back to the Iran war, I distinct it from the Iraq war, just because I think Iran has been a much more aggressive and hostile, depending on your argument, to its neighbors, like specifically our ally in the Middle East. I know the first Gulf War, feel free to jump in, by the way, whenever.
No, make your case. I can remember your statements. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. I know with the first Gulf War, I think the U.S. claimed that they were defending Kuwait, right? And Kuwait is the U.S. ally. So they said, oh, we're defending our ally.
No, it's a weapons of mass destruction argument. I mean, there certainly was the Kuwait issue and so on. But if you remember the yellow cake, the aluminum tubes, the yellow cake refinement, and Donald Rumsfeld saying, oh, no, we know where they are. They're to the north and the east and the west, and they're in the wind, and they're in the Wizard of Oz land and maybe Middle Earth. So they said it's a slam dunk case. Colin Powell made that case to the U.N. It's a slam dunk case. They absolutely 100% have weapons of mass destruction, and we're going in there because, as Condoleezza Rice said, we don't want the smoking gun to be in the form of a mushroom cloud that an American city was going to get quadruple Hiroshima or something like that. And so it very much was a threat to the American homeland that they were going in to stop. Kuwait was certainly somewhat of an excuse, but not the primary way in which it was sold, that the homeland was going to be nuked or biochemical or some sort of horrendous weapon was going to be unleashed in America. And that's why they had to go in. And of course, there was no weapons of mass destruction, and the evidence was mostly faked.
Yes, I agree. The government, centralized power is not a good thing. And the U.S. has a lot of centralized power right now. I do want to defend, like, say, President Trump for a second. He's been an unusually, I would say, restrained president with that, the amount of power he has. I know during the first term, they said no new worlds. He had that brief one in Syria. If you look at Venezuela, for example, it's been quite restrained. They did arrest Maduro, and I don't think there were any civilian casualties. Maybe there were very few. But I think it's been a check on Venezuela's power. Again, I'm not saying that Venezuela is good now, and it's horrible what just happened with that that earthquake. I just saw it, earlier today. But I think their government, that was a big check on their power. I do believe, and we obviously agree, all power needs to be checked at minimum. That was a big check on the Venezuela government's power. I would argue something similar may be happening in Iran. We don't know. I don't know. We'll see what happens. We don't even know if the current Ayatollah is still alive or who would be the leader. It might be somebody in the IRGC or whatever. We know the president doesn't have much power. But you brought up Bush administration. Yes, that we could talk all day about the condemnations they deserve. I think Trump has been an unusually restrained even more so than Obama and perhaps Clinton, I would argue.
Mm. Well, I think that's true. And I imagine, and I think this is fairly well established, that Benjamin Netanyahu was telling Trump, just decapitate the Iranian leadership and it will all start sprouting rainbows and unicorns and roses. And I think he went in thinking it was going to be something like that. At least that's my impression. And of course, it turned out not to be really anything like that. And I know that the Iranians, what was it, somewhere between $270 billion and $900 billion in reparations. I know Trump says no to that. But if they end up reopening the Strait of Hormuz, that was already there beforehand. If they have to pay hundreds of billions of dollars, that's a problem as well. And the fact that they didn't decapitate the Iranian leadership has caused, of course, as you point out, huge problems with the Strait of Hormuz. And everybody knows about the oil, but the oil is not the most important stuff that goes through the Strait of Hormuz. What is important that goes through the Strait of Hormuz is like the nitrogen-based fertilizer, because without the fertilizer, you can't feed the planet. And if you can't feed the planet, then people go on the move and they tend to go towards places like Europe or other places. And that's very destabilizing for a lot of those countries. So I think, if there's one thing, and it's easy to say from the outside, Lord knows, right? But I think if there's one thing that I would say about Trump is that, as we saw with the pandemic, he tends to listen to, quote, experts. And you and I'm sure, are skeptical of just about all authority, maybe my dentist. I think my dentist as a whole has my best interests at heart. I still have my wisdom teeth. But Trump is like, oh, great. So we just go in and, toss a couple of bombs and we get a lovely democratic free market regime change. And of course, that hasn't happened. And we'll see how that plays out. But the Strait of Hormuz is a very, very big deal. And the other question about nuclear weapons, well, I mean, gosh, I mean, if you look at the countries that have nuclear weapons that are evil dictatorships, of course, North Korea, China, dictatorships, Pakistan and India, Belarus hosts Russian tactical nukes under under Russia's control, and a dictatorship under Alexander Lukashenko, and so on. And so there are countries that are dangerous and dictatorial and so on that have nukes. And the fact that a country has nukes generally doesn't mean it's going to use them. Of course, the only country that's ever used them in war is America because of the obvious mutually assured destruction scenario. So having an evil country have nukes, even though there's been a fatwa on the development of nukes, there has been some independent verifications and so on. And of course, I assume that the government is lying about everything. So when they say Iran is 4 weeks away from getting nukes, but they've been saying that since I was in high school. And I'm afraid that's a lot longer than the time since you were in high school. So I would say that, and of course, under communist dictatorship, I grew up with them having nukes, which they never used. So the idea that, you know, if they get nukes, they're going to use them and it's going to be a third world war. I mean, there's evil dictatorships out there. They don't use them because the moment somebody launches a nuke, everybody launches their nukes at them and the whole country is destroyed. Now, of course, everybody's aware of that, which is why mutually assured destruction has meant no World War III, despite massive tensions for the past 70 years. So I don't view that as a particularly compelling reason. And we'll see what they end up signing. But I want to give you a chance to respond to that before I gish gallop all over your forehead.
Oh, no, you're good. Well, one thing about just, I agree with you. The case we made was for the Iran war. But I would argue for intervening in Iran, I argue, just this is offhand, talking to you, I argue that this does apply to North Korea for sure. I think, I don't know what the population is there. I think it's 30, 40, 50 million. Those people are in hell. However, I don't think we should intervene. And here's why, is that I wouldn't want to piss off China. And I think this could lead to that could be a whole host of problems. And I give Trump credit again. I think he's done well with, yes, the U.S. was aggressive in Iran, but has been able to maintain good relations, at least so far, I'm assuming, with China and Russia, even though they're allied with Iran, or at least one of the, I think Russia is at least. And I know China gets a lot of their oil from Iran. Trump has actually done a very good diplomatic, whatever he's had to do with Russia and China on this matter. The main reason, main argument against North Korea is I think it would totally destroy any U.S. relationship with North Korea, China.
Well, and then who would do gain-of-function coronavirus research? We wouldn't want to harm that relationship, right? Well, the other thing, too, of course, you could argue that, of course, Iran being a Islamic dictatorship, that messing with them is also going to annoy some Muslim extremists around the world, and that could be a problem as well. So I'm not sure that you solve that problem just because of geography, because belief systems match around the world as well. And, of course, again, it's so tempting, and I'm not saying you or Dr. Block are saying this, but, snap your fingers and we get a free, liberated Iran. I made the case on X. One of the things that is quite different between Iran and Iraq is close to a standard deviation difference in average IQ. And so I would assume that this is one of the reasons why liberating South Korea, which has a very high IQ, is quite a bit different from liberating Afghanistan, where it's not quite the same. So it certainly would be closer. I think if I had to put money on it, would end up better and so on. But the big challenge is that I sort of look at Washington, D.C., and I say, well, and I've been to Washington a number of times. And I mean, it's a weird place because it's like blink and you're in a totally different neighborhood. Like, hey, it's really nice here. And then like cross one line and it's like, twitchy fentanyl zombies and cars on fire. And like, it's just nuts. And so I think, well, politicians in D.C., they can't make D.C. peaceful, productive, happy, healthy, and good. Can they do it in Iran, where there's a language barrier, it's on the other side of the world, cultural differences, religious differences, and so on? Like, if you can't fix what's outside your window, I don't know that you can fix what's on the other side of the world. I have that skepticism. I have war is just another government program. Of course, you're old enough to remember the awful things that happened in Libya, where Gaddafi, of course, was somewhat of a secular dictator, but at least he was a barrier to the general flood of people into Europe, which he openly said was going to happen, that if Libya was taken out, the people would flood into Europe, as of course did turn out to be the case. And of course, there was no open-air slave markets where you could buy actual human beings for $400, which happened after the intervention and the bayonet assault on the nether regions of Gaddafi and so on. So that has turned out to be complete catastrophe. We look at Somalia, interventions there tends to be a complete catastrophe. We can kind of do that as a whole. But what I also say is that if you fuel the military-industrial complex, which is where the money flows in these kinds of conflicts, so if they say, well, if there's a tyranny, man, we'll go in and fix it, then unfortunately, the American military-industrial complex has a very strong incentive to keep creating tyrannies. Because if tyranny is the standard by which we're willing to forego violations of the non-aggression principle and support the government program called war, then unfortunately, in the long run, they're just going to keep creating tyrannies, as they seem to have done pretty regularly. They're going to keep creating tyrannies so that they can keep creating these wars that never seem to get the peace they promise.
Yeah. I agree with you. I mean, a lot of that you're preaching to the choir is, governments are the most incompetent force on planet Earth. Even, these big corporations, there's a lot of incompetencies there. Doesn't even compare to some bloated government bureaucracy. And the U.S. might be one of the most incompetent. My argument here is just partially is, what's our alternative if we're, and I agree, we kind of went over it a little bit of just, private funding, get the billionaires who really want Iran's government changed or something, try and get them to fund some private army. And I agree, there should be that. And if that's a cause I focus on the rest of my life, I will happily do that. I'm still in my 30s. That could be something I could work towards. But right now, we're not going to live forever. If in the moment right now we want to just liberate some people, who else can we really go to other than, the U.S. government's really the only one that's able to do it. Not even Europe, I don't think, could really do it. So that's partially my response. But again, I do that knowing the government is horrifically, pathetically incompetent and doesn't know what they're doing. But then again, I could cite, in World War II, the U.S. fought Germany and Japan and whatever, and there was some competency there. Competency enough to win the war. Although Russians would argue they won the war. Just point being is, I don't know our alternative. If we're going to help the Iranian people, what is the alternative?
Well, that's a good question, and it is certainly incumbent upon people who say, let's not do this, to say, let's do that. And so I certainly agree with that. Let me just push back a little bit about...
Sure. Push back on everything.
Yeah. So if we look at something like the American economy right now, children are born into close to $2 million of debt and unfunded liabilities. That's a horrendous amount of enslavement. Just because you get to choose your own job doesn't mean that you're not a slave. And this sort of indentured servitude, children in America are born into the kind of debt they can never, ever get free of. Like, they will never, ever be able to pay that debt off. I don't know how that gets solved. It doesn't get solved by going to try and solve the problems in Iran. I did have a look, and maybe you feel the same way, that drug use and prostitution for most libertarians are victimless crimes. They're not actual crimes. However much we may dislike drug use and prostitution, it is not a violation of the non-aggression principle for there to be prostitution or for there to be drugs. And in America, every decade, there's 10 to 15 million drug arrests per decade, millions of people thrown in jail for nonviolent crimes. That seems important. As a whole, I generally say that the Iranian people, and this is no shade upon the Iranian people, none whatsoever. I want to be clear about that up front, but it is simply an objective way of looking at the situation. The Iranian people have chosen to suffer the dictatorship rather than risk death in opposing it. And again, I don't have any shade. This is no shade on them, but it is a simple fact. And the problem, and this may sound harsh towards you, it may be unfair, but I'm certainly happy to be corrected on that. It's real easy to say other people should die for their freedoms, but you're not dying for your freedom. I'm not dying for my freedom. And I have a tough time saying that other people should die for their freedom. So the argument would be, let's say that space aliens came down and said, boy, that American government is a real dictatorship, and we're only going to, you know, kill 5 or 10% of the American population in order to liberate themselves. And let's say that included you or your family or your friends or your kids, if you have them and so on. It'd be like, you know, I think I'll hang in there. I think I'll just wait for the future to get better. I'll do whatever little bit I can in the same way that the Russians waited for things to get better under communism, as Stalin and Khrushchev and Brezhnev and so on. They waited for things to get better, and they were right. Right, because invading Russia would have killed, you know, 10 million Russians or more, probably. And so they just waited for things to get better, and things did eventually get better. And we can think of a whole bunch of times where people have waited for things to get better, and things have, in general, improved. I mean, there's no guillotining of people in the public square in France at the moment, though there was, of course, under the Reign of Terror, and people just lowered their heads and did what little they could. And that's not inconsequential. We can all do our own little bits to make the world freer, and they just wait for things to get better. And if I have a tough time, and, you know, maybe you can lead me to the promised land on this, but I have a tough time saying Iranians should die for their freedom, because I don't think that's my decision to make. I can support them in their endeavors. I can donate if there's a good cause. I can promote freedom around the world. I can do all of these kinds of good things. It can be massive moral sympathies and so on. But it's tough, man. You know, you and Walter Block, man, none of you are going to suffer any physical injuries or death in the liberation of Iraq. And the Iraqis have generally, as most people do, right? Most people don't, you know, stand tall against the big machine and end up against the wall. And I know that that's what Solzhenitsyn said maybe should happen under the Soviet Gulag system, but they have chosen to live with the ills and wait for them to pass. I don't know that we, you or I or Dr. Block or anyone, can make that decision and say, nope, we're going to feed you into the cannons because your society deserves to be free.
And by the way, yes, I agree. And I agree with everything you're saying in terms of the spending and all that. You know, the U.S. government is out of control, and I don't know if that'll change. You know, we'll see in the 2028 election.
Oh, it'll change. Math is math, man. It'll change.
Well, they're going to print their way out of it. That's my assumption, you know, long term. But
that's still a change, though. But and eventually that will just collapse too, right? I mean, math is math.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that is a fair point, by the way. Why am I not lacing up my boots and heading to Iran? My answer is this. Actually, I am willing to. I am willing to go over there. I'm 38. I am absolutely willing to go over there, and I will die if I can help get 90 million people free. The reason why, and I'm willing to do that if there is a program where Americans can sign up, and it's, you're only going to fight in this war with Iran. There's not, oh, you have to serve 10 years. You might go fight in Iraq, blah, blah, blah. No. Only, it's kind of like World War II. I think Americans, they signed up. They went to Germany or France or wherever they had to fight Germany, or they went to Japan. And then they, if they survived, you know, God willing, they came home. I'm willing to do that. I am willing to go over there and do that. The problem is with the U.S. military, I feel like I'm signing up and I'm signing away my life for 4 years, and I could be doing, I don't have a, you know, just to be blunt with you, I don't have a lot of respect for the U.S. military right now. I think it's so corrupt and unbelievably bad. And don't, I'm not downplaying the soldiers. I love them. They're great people. But I think the leadership is very corrupt, and especially under Biden. I remember, not to get sidetracked, apologies if I'm sidetracked, but I just had no respect for any of these generals. I was like, my God, who would go and serve under these people? They're awful. Like, they're so abominable. I couldn't believe, and by the way, I don't know if much has changed under Trump. I like Pete Hegseth, by the way. I knew him and I met him at Fox many times. Really sweet guy. Really, the way the media portrays him is not accurate. He's a very sweet, you would, if you met him and had him on your show, you probably would agree with him on certain things. And he's more libertarian than you would think. Don't get me wrong. I think, you know, I don't agree with him on everything, but a sweet man. Sorry to get sidetracked, but yeah, one, you know, fair enough. I'm 38. I could serve in Iran, and I'm not doing it right now, but if there was a program, I really would. And you could hold me to it. Your audience could hold me to it. You can troll me on, you know, X. Well, why aren't you going over there and serving? Okay, fair point. And again, as for the dead, I agree. I just wonder, you know, the U.S., it's interesting. I did look it up, you know, just because I know these are a typical, like a frequent response of just, you know, the debt is out of control. We're going to add more debt by this Iran stuff, which is true. But I don't know if it's that consequential, because right now, if you look at the U.S. budget, government. So if you just how much they pay in interest on the debt combined with Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Not, you know, Canadian audience. I assume they know what these are.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we're globally, but we have, you know, government programs and then the interest on the debt. That's 60% of the budget, and it's going up. And the defense, I think, is somewhere like 5% of the budget, something like that. So it's a much, don't get me wrong, yes, any extra spending is immoral, and I would agree with you on that. But I don't think it's anywhere near as consequential as, you know, what we're thinking here. But not that that defends it. I'm just saying it's, you know, the U.S. is a mess for many other reasons, and I don't know if the defense budget is 100% the reason. So anyway, if you wanted to respond to that, go for it.
I mean, that's totally right. But there, of course, are the spillover costs. If you look at the cost of funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Soviets was pretty low, you know, maybe 10 million, maybe 15 million or something like that, pretty low. But then if you look at the long-term blowback effects on the economy of the resulting 9/11, because after training them, they were pretty good at war and they were very upset about the stationing of American troops in Saudi Arabia, so they decided to hit 9/11. And now everyone can below say, no, it was an inside job. Okay, so everyone can just get that out of the way, but this is, I go with the mainstream on that. So the blowback effects are quite considerable, not just the direct costs. And I did a little bit here because, you know, I look at the resume. Like if I want to hire someone, I look at the resume, right? So you want to hire the American government to have a successful regime change, right? That's good. You know, you want to pay and you're willing to fight. I mean, it's a little bit, I get your intention, but of course it's not going to happen. So it's like, the moment the pigs can fly, I'm going to do this big dangerous thing. That's never going to happen. So, I mean, I appreciate the intention, but it's not a serious thing because it's not going to happen that you can just sign up for this war. But so I look at the resume, right? I used to be a hiring manager. I interviewed like 1,000 people. I've hired like 100 people and I look at the resume, right? I say, can you do this job? So I'll just go through this real quick. From 19, this is just 45 onwards, right? I mean, it's pretty clear to me that one of the main reasons communism took over in Russia in 1917 was because America entered into World War I. And because America entered into World War I, Germany funded Lenin through Finland with arms and money to go and take over the government to take Russia out of the war. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why a third of the world ended up under communism was the intervention in World War I. But if you look at, you know, what they do, 1945 to 1955, there were post-World War II occupations in Germany, Austria, Japan, South Korea, other places. And you could argue not too bad, right? Not too bad. I mean, everyone talks about the Marshall Plan like it saved Europe. And of course, it was all nonsense. It was all just corrupt. And the market economy reforms saved Europe. 1950 to 53, the Korean War. Stabilized South Korea, created ongoing demilitarized zone tensions and U.S. commitment, and it wasn't great for North Korea, as we talked about before. 1953, of course, there was the Iran coup, Operation Ajax, CIA was doing this covert with the U.K., and that was bad in the long term. It overthrew the elected prime minister and installed and reinforced the Shah, but fueled resentment, which led up to the 1979 revolution and, of course, decades of hostility. 1950 more. The CIA covert Guatemala coup removed elected government, led to decades of civil war and instability. 1958, Lebanon intervention. Well, we can see what Lebanon is like now. Just ask Gad Saad. And that's not great. 60, 61, Bay of Pigs invasion. That was terrible. 61, they did a variety of advisory roles in various Latin America counterinsurgency support. Not great. 64 to 73, of course, the Vietnam War. Terrible communist victory, regional spillover, massive costs, long-term instability. 1965, Dominican Republic intervention, prevented perceived leftist takeover, restored order but controversial. 60s to 70s, covert support in Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam War extension, decreased stability, contributed to regional destabilization and the rise of the Khmer Rouge, who, you know, slaughtered people in per capita, one of the highest butchery shops in history. And I won't read through all of this. I'll put it in the show notes, but it goes on for four pages of pretty small font where there's almost no unqualified successes. Now, of course, America was founded on an internal rebellion, which, you know, to some degree was encouraged and a little bit funded by France. But That was not an external country coming in to liberate it. That was internal, and that was a different matter. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I'm thinking about something in real time because I really haven't thought about this or expressed this, and you'll be the, you know, I'm going to throw it in your direction. You let me know. You know, that was at a time, you think about back in all those interventions, you know, there wasn't the news apparatus or the communication we have today, like, you know, social media, the internet. So a lot of Americans probably had no idea, or at least there was probably, I can only imagine there was very few people, certainly the mainstream, I could not imagine was reporting on all these of just what was going on in Dominican Republic, what was going on over here, over there, over there. I doubt that a lot of Americans even knew. I think one good thing about today is if the U.S. is going to go do something, we're going to know about it immediately. And we can immediately, like, people can oppose it or check in and be like, what are you doing in, like, Dominican Republic or in Chile right now? Like, this is ridiculous. Don't get me wrong. I know we talked about it earlier, there's 120 bases. Do I know what's going on in all those bases? I don't know.
It was 120 of the bio labs that Tulsi Gabbard was just talking about on her last day.
Well, yeah, no, I heard, and good.
I think there are over 800 military bases around the world from America.
Oh, yeah, some insane amount. And I know a lot of them are left over from World War II, where the U.S. just didn't dismantle them. They built them and then just kept them, which is not good. I think they should. Now, again, I don't know if all those bases are, Japan wants us to keep them there, and South Korea does, you know, we have a deal with them. I don't know enough about it. That, I would guess that's why. You might know differently than me, but I would guess that's why they might be there. But I truly believe, going back to like the 40, you know, we talked, this started in 45. I don't think the U.S. government had a lot of checks on their power back then. I mean, the Soviet Union did, you know, they were probably like, oh, look at what the U.S. is doing over here. But I don't think there was a lot. I think there's a lot more today. You know, there's much more international organizations. A lot of people are more informed, I would argue today. Maybe we could disagree about that. But at least with mass media and communication, people can at least go, what in the world is going on? And, you know, what is the U.S. government doing here? And so I would try and argue, and especially in the age of Trump, you know, I'm not just, you know, tooting Trump's horn here of just, I have found him in my lifetime. I find him to be the best president of my lifetime. And I was born in the late 1980s. And in terms of foreign policy, I think it's been the best foreign policy. He has been mostly restrained. And so when it comes to like Iran, I feel like this one is a little bit more of a, not necessarily selection. Obviously, they got involved because Israel went to them and said, hey, we know the Ayatollah is going to be at this meeting. We're going to go kill him. And so the U.S. kind of had to make a decision. Do we want to be involved or don't we? That's my understanding. I don't know if you think differently, but that's my understanding. So we got involved. You know, we could argue maybe it was a good move. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. Maybe we should just let Israel do it. I don't know where you stand on that. But I just find the foreign policy, at least under Trump, not so much under Obama or Bush, but I find it much more restrained than we've had. And, you know, certainly more than the 40s. You know, I find it a much more selective, restrained foreign policy. What say you?
Oh, yes. Listen, I did a whole show on how corrupt and immoral Obama was. And it was horrendous under whatever decaying brain orbit Biden was presiding over from 2020 to 2024. No borders and just crazy stuff going on. Without a doubt, for me, Trump is a peace guy. He's a capitalist. He's a builder. And I think he abhors war as a whole. And so he kind of has to be talked into it with a lot of sweet, seductive words. And I don't really count the one in Syria. I did a show on it back in the day. That was a warning. It was a bombing of a airport with almost nobody there. So that was really nothing compared to what was going on over the previous, I don't know, 60 years. So I agree with you that Trump is restrained. He is a peace guy. And this was something that was enormously tempting to him because he was told, you know, hey, couple of bombs and you get a free 90 million people. I mean, who wouldn't take that deal? Right. Who wouldn't take that deal? If I believed that deal, you couldn't stop me from signing it quick enough with, like, you know, four security guards. I'd chew my way through them. If it's like, hey, you know, we just send a couple of bombs, we take out a couple of these evil leaders and you get 90 million people free in the region. Oh, my gosh. But you know, it is one of these principles of life that if something seems too good to be true, it probably is. And it has turned out that, of course, the Iranians are very intelligent, as I mentioned before. They're Caucasian in general, so we've got the sort of average IQ there. But they're perfectly aware that America's going to want to decapitate their leadership, and they've known this for decades, and that America is averse to boots on the ground in general, right? Ever since Vietnam, they're averse to boots on the ground, and they love using their air power. So This is one of the first things you have to ask when you have an enemy, we'll call, let's say that the current leadership in Iran is an enemy of America. I mean, when they say the great Satan and death to America, we can take them at their word. So the first thing you want to do is assume that your enemy is intelligent and has figured out your extremely obvious plans. The extremely obvious plans being America loves using air power or special ops to decapitate leadership, particularly under Trump, and Trump is averse to ground troops. America is averse to ground troops, and especially after the debacles in Somalia and in Iraq and in Afghanistan and other places, Vietnam onwards, ground troops is kind of a no-no with the American public as a whole, and so they're going to want to try and decapitate the leadership with air power and drones and missiles and so on. So, of course, what is Iran going to do? Well, they're going to build their whole system to survive that, right? It's like saying if you know your enemy has big bombs, then you build big shelters because you know they've got big bombs. So I'm not sure that Trump gave the due respect, and I don't mean respect like they're worthy of moral respect, but, you know, respect the intelligence of your enemy. I don't think he just gave the basic thing of saying, okay, so they know we want to go in there, decapitate them with air power and have no boots on the ground. So what have they done in anticipation of that risk? Right? It's like going into a fight with Mike Tyson and not protecting your ear. You know, he's going to go for your ear, man. It's going to go for your ear. So I think saying, well, you know, we can just do it easy. We can decapitate them and then we'll free 90 million people. And it's like, but they know that that's what we want to do. So if I was Trump, I would say, what have they done to prepare for that very obvious move that we've got?
And by the way, I think you're right. And this I concede totally is that Trump, and I think the most obvious, you actually didn't mention it, I'm surprised you didn't, was the Strait of Hormuz. I don't know if they really thought that Iran was going to close it or thought it through.
If they thought they just decapitate the leadership and then they, you know, the people rise up and then it's going to stay open, right?
Yeah. My argument, though, on that is just, and I didn't, by the way, I didn't think of it either. I just, you know, when I saw this, I'm kind of reacting in real time. I'm now thinking, I'm curious your thoughts on this. I don't mean to switch the subject, by the way. We can get back to this, but I am curious on your point on this. Like the Strait of Hormuz, for example, it is an international waterway. It's not like it's a canal like the Suez Canal or the Panama Canal. It is kind of, you know, goes to, you know, Yemen's there, Bahrain and UAE and Saudi Arabia. Would you argue that, you know, and it's probably something we didn't think about. I certainly didn't, and Trump obviously didn't, and, you know, probably nobody in the U.S., Marco Rubio or whatever. Should we have, some... not defense, but just some agreement with the countries of like, this waterway stays open no matter what. And if anybody tries to violate it, you know, we do something against them. But do you have any thoughts on that? Or
I've been a negotiator for many years. When I was in the business world, I spent many years as a negotiator. And the way that I would approach the problem with Strait of Hormuz is to make sure that the West was as open to energy drilling and nitrogen production as humanly possible. Like, I'm sure you know that Saudi Arabia did its part to fund the environmental movement to shut down the oil drilling and oil generation capacities of the West so that more money could flow into Saudi Arabia. So what I would do is I would liberate the markets, certainly if I was king of the America, whatever, right? I would liberate the markets, drill, baby, drill, man, the Arctic, and establish very close relations with Canada to trade that way. And, you know, America has, particularly with Alaska, has absolutely enough oil to deal with all of its needs. So rather than say, who's going to police the Strait of Hormuz, I would say, why do we even need the Strait of Hormuz? Well, we need the Strait of Hormuz in America because of all of this restrictions on drilling and energy production and energy storage and so on. And so I would really challenge the environmental people. I would check their funding and see if it's coming from some pretty sinister forces and use whatever would be needed to shut that off. But rather than saying, how do we protect the Strait of Hormuz? I would say, why do we even care about the Strait of Hormuz? And the answer is because not enough domestic energy production is allowed, and therefore we need it. And so to me, the solution is always more freedom. Like you said, well, what would I do? Well, what I would do is liberate America as much as humanly possible, as it would with every country in the world. But let's say, you know, somebody's in charge of, well, if somebody is in charge of America, maybe it's Trump, maybe it's not, I don't know, whoever's got the Epstein tapes. But I would say, focus on building as free and prosperous and beautiful a society as humanly possible, and hope that that message spreads. You know, like, I don't nag people about exercise what I do is I exercise. And then, you know, when I go running up a hill for 10 minutes and people are like, wow, you're almost 60, you can do that. I'm like, yeah. And then, and hopefully people, you know, I don't nag people about eating well. I just try to maintain a reasonably healthy weight and so on. I try not to nag people about being virtuous. I just try to be decent and honest myself, as I know you do as well. So it is always the big question is, do you go and thump people who are doing the wrong thing, or do you focus on doing the right thing yourself and hope to inspire people? There's this cheesy story that I read when I was a kid that always comes to mind with things like this, which is there's this guy walking down the street, walking down the country lane, and he's got a cloak around his back, and the sun and the moon are having an argument, right? And the sun and the wind are having an argument about who's more powerful, right? And the wind says, well, I'm more powerful. I'm more powerful because I can go and rip that cloak off the guy's back. And the sun says, I don't believe you. And then the wind goes flying down and, you know, rips at the guy's cloak. But of course, the guy just closes around it tighter and all of that. And then eventually the wind gives up because he can't get the cloak off the guy's back. And it says, well, you can't do it. And what does the sun do? Well, the sun just beams hotter and hotter until the guy's like, oh my God, I'm dying of heat. And he takes the coat off, right? Takes his cloak off. And so do you use this kind of aggression to get people to change? Or are you the shining beacon, the shining city, wherein at some point people are like, they've got it going on, man. I want some of that. And of course, that happens in America quite a bit. I think it's happening less and less in America or in the West as a whole. And I remember when I did my documentary on Hong Kong and I went out there to march with the anti-communist protesters taking lovely facefuls of tear gas for my troubles. And I remember saying that, you know, what should America do about Hong Kong? And it's like, well, you should, of course, make the moral case, property rights, non-aggression principle, and all that kind of small to no government as best as can be achieved in whatever time span we can. But I think you want to focus on your own virtues before going and blowing other people up for their lack of virtues, because violence has a lot of blowback. And I don't know that anyone really can handle the power of an $800 billion military budget and the capacity to leap over the Constitution and go and bomb whoever they want. That is a lot of power. I don't believe people can handle power at all. And so encouraging and hoping that the use of that kind of power is going to lead to a positive and moral outcome, I think is a lesson I don't know that we need to learn again. But I think, well, certainly I would argue that you and Walter Block seem to, but you're certainly making a good case.
Well, thank you for the compliment. That's very nice of you. But, you and I totally philosophically agree on, 99% of things. And I agree with you. All power needs to be checked at all times, including the U.S. government, especially the U.S. government. The U.S. government still has the most power on Earth. And I agree with you 100% on why are we not drilling in Alaska? Why are we not drilling in all these places or offshore or whatever? It's unbelievable to me. And by the way, I didn't know. You said it earlier. You're like, oh, I'm sure you know that Saudi Arabia, funds all these. I didn't, but it doesn't surprise me because it's, good for their bottom line. So they're funding that. My argument on that is I do wonder, U.S. allies, and this could be I don't know what direction you want to go with the conversation, but we could talk about allies and the concept of how that affects libertarianism or just whatever. Is just how much of our allies are getting, like, how much does Europe, what is their oil at all coming from? This I probably should have been more prepared for this debate and looked it up online, of just how much is Europe getting from Hormuz? Who actually is getting the oil? I know China is. I know certain parts of Southeast Asia, Thailand certainly does. I don't know, India, I'm certain does. And also, by the way, talking about human innovation, at least to my understanding, they do have another pipeline that runs through Saudi Arabia. I think it might go through Oman or Yemen, and then it comes out into the Red Sea. And so they have that oil, but it's already at capacity, but apparently they're expanding it. Apparently there might be like another one, or there just might be other ways. So we might not, Hormuz could be just a non sequitur long-term. Just responding to your point of just why do we even care about the Strait of Hormuz? Maybe it's, might be an ally thing, or just, could be just stupid environmental policies. But either way, you and I would agree. My argument would just kind of be based on of just how do we prevent this, energy issue coming up, because we're going into the age of AI. You and I are both in, by the way, hopefully I see you again. We can talk about many other things, AI or what all the other innovations and how we respond to it. But I know it requires a lot of energy. Our energy use, for the first time in decades, by the way, certainly in the West, has gone through the roof because of AI. I don't know if you know that. I was looking at the numbers the other day. Energy use was kind of flat for like 10, 20 years. But abruptly with AI, it's like spiked out of the moon. So energy has become, so I think one of the reasons why Strait of Hormuz is like everybody's losing their minds is we need that energy for AI. But anyways, yeah, what say you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point. I know Elon Musk is looking to put AI in orbit because it could just vent all the heat off into space. It doesn't need liquid and it can get all of its energy from the sun without the issues of clouds or the atmosphere causing problems. So if you ever have a problem, the giant Pac-Man brain of Elon Musk is pretty much gonna solve it. I did look this up. The EU only gets about 3% or less of its total supply through local crude. It imported in 2025 430 to 480 million tons of petroleum oils. Of course, Russia's share is near zero because of the sanctions since the war in Ukraine, since 2022. So the United States sends 14 to 15% of Europe's oil to Europe. Well, that seems a bit odd, right? I mean, if the United States needs oil from other places, it's got to come through the Strait of Hormuz. Why is it shipping? It comes from someplace through the Strait of Hormuz all the way across the ocean, and then it goes back to Europe all the way across the ocean and so on, right? So the EU. So Norway, that's the major non-EU supplier via pipelines and tankers. Now, here's the funny thing. I'm not particularly good with this stuff. If somebody said to me Norway was not in the EU, I'd be like, really? Kazakhstan, Libya gives some, Saudi Arabia 6 to 7%, Nigeria and Iraq 5 to 6% each. So before 2022, Russia supplied 25 to 30% of EU crude oil. So that is generally where it comes from. But it's the old thing that Europe as a whole, I would argue that because America has disproportionately taken over protection of Europe, Europe has had to have almost no military, which means that Europe has trillions of euros available to pay migrants to come. So like America, by taking over the protection to a large degree of Europe, has left, you know, socialism and social engineering euros by the trillions in the hands of wild, crazy ideological bureaucrats and, you know, arguably could be the end of the sort of historical continuity of Europe as a whole for a variety of reasons, not just including migration. But, I mean, yeah, so that's another sort of a subsidized social program that leads to other distortions in the marketplace. The fact that Christianity has had a history of significant conflict with Islam, and the fact that Christian hyper-empathy for nature produced the environmental movement, which again was partly funded by Saudi Arabia and other countries that are all producing for obvious reasons. Well, that means that, you know, untold trillions of dollars have flowed into largely Muslim-controlled countries where they use that to spread Islam, as is their wont and has been their historical commandments and so on. So the environmental movement is significantly funded by both foreign actors as well as universities that are funded by taxpayers and so on. So when I look at all of these webs, I say, well, it all comes back to just violations of the non-aggression principle. I mean, the environmental activists lobby to ban drilling. Well, why would you ban drilling? You couldn't ban drilling in a truly free society. I mean, you could buy land and then people couldn't drill on it, but you couldn't just write a piece of paper in an air-conditioned office and shut down all of Alaska to oil drilling. Like, that wouldn't be a thing in the free market. So all of these things, and, you know, I hate to use this, like, it's so incredibly complicated because that's a bit of a, oh, look how smart I am. But I will say that if I look at a lot of these sorts of issues, I drill back to violations of the non-aggression principle, overreach in government power, politics, bureaucracy, debt, and so on. And so when you and Dr. Block are like, okay, just one more. One more government program, one more violation of the non-aggression principle, and we'll free 90 million people. I don't believe it.
And fair enough. Part of it is, you know, just going on just the direct, you know, your direct criticism on that in terms of, you know, the taxation and the money printing to fund the war. Yeah, I agree. Part of it is based on Trump's history of restraint. Also of just... Basically, we live in a world, and, you know, I'm going to take this a little bit in a different direction and might put you a little on the defensive of just, you know, we live in a world where the non-aggression principle is violated pretty much at every moment of every day by every government, other than a select few. I'm curious, hopefully in the future we could talk about Prospera. I don't know if you've heard of them, that, you know, the island building, the economic zone in Honduras, and other ones that are building around the world that I am promoting There's a new crypto one based one called Logos, and they have circles around the world. Love to talk to you about that sometime.
I remember talking to about seasteading like 15 years ago with, I can't remember his name. Was it one of the Friedmans? Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Peter Thiel, I think also, you know, people were promoting that, but then, you know, they tried doing French Polynesia and then the French Polynesia King said, no, we're not doing that. But they wanted to build like a seasteading colony there or something. And by the way, that's what I want to work on the rest of my life. And, you know, as far as this goes, here's what I worry about with libertarians and why I left the Libertarian Party. I literally renounced my membership in the U.S. because first it went woke. I don't know if you saw, in the U.S. at least did. It was cringy and painfully awful. So I just said, I'm out of here. And the criticism I'm getting back in terms of blowback from libertarians, and here's my criticism to them of just, I don't want to get into a situation where we're an all or nothing kind of party. It's like everything needs to go this way. And if not, then we don't do any of it. So I agree with you. I don't like violating or supporting any violation of the non-negotiation principle, supporting any taxation or, you know, we got to print more money to fund this war or whatever. I would challenge, though, I don't know if we are printing that much more. I mean, you know, the U.S. debt is out of control. They're already printing already. But I would just worry, and I am really curious about your response to this, of the all or nothing kind of thing of just, okay, yes, I agree, bad things are happening in Iran, but we're not going to challenge it because we don't want to print more money or we don't want to be hypocrites of, you know, using taxpayer money to fund the military. That's what I worry about where the Libertarian Party is. And in the U.S., just as a fact, the party's popularity, like results in elections, has gone way down. Like it's not actually improving. It's going down. Now, it could be, you know, there could be a variety of reasons for that. It might not just be the reasons I listed, but it is going down and something's off where we're not convincing people properly or we're not going to them. So that's my worry about that situation. Anyway, sorry. Yes, go for it.
No, excellent points. I just came back from visiting some friends in New Hampshire who were also part of the Free State Project, and I got quite the cannon full of outrage about where libertarianism is in America. And I would agree with that. It's the only place really where there's any libertarian movement of any consequences at all. And yes, it has gone kind of woke. So, I mean, libertarians and I parted ways, I think probably close to about 20 years ago, because I did focus. I've got a whole book called Peaceful Parenting, peacefulparenting.com, available for free. There's an AI for free to ask questions.
I read it. A great book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that. So this is sort of my business experience where you focus on the most value that you have the most control over. Right. So I can say, well, you know, if we got 10% of this market in China, we'd be zillionaires. And it's like, do you have any way of getting that market? No. It's like, well, then, you know, maybe don't worry about it so much. And so focusing, because I did a lot of research and development, spending and management and so on. And so you look at where's the biggest bang for your buck that you can actually do something about. And so when it came to the non-aggression principle, I'm sure as you're aware, for over 20 years, even before I became a public dude, I was talking about spanking, child abuse, and so on as what libertarians should focus on, because the most widespread violation of the non-aggression principle that we could do the most about is child abuse and spanking. And spanking is definitely a violation of the non-aggression principle, and we can do a lot about it. And it's going to produce a lot of really great people if we don't keep raising people as a whole and with violence. So that was the general idea. And I know some libertarians came along, but other libertarians thought I was a full on, God, what's that guy? The doc in with the crazy hair in Back to the Future, Doc Brown, right? I was full on Doc Brown, magnesium runs the world and spanking is everything. And so we did sort of part ways and they went down the realm of politics. Of course, one of the problems is that even if we could, or if there was some ability to relatively peacefully overthrow the Iranian regime. Let's say that we could do that in some manner and it worked. Okay, so then what happens? Well, who goes in? Who goes in to rebuild the society? Well, a bunch of socialists, a bunch of woketards, a bunch of lunatics who are going to go in and plow, because they're all going to need to be educated, which means they're all going to have to jump through the academic hoops of inherent brain distortion that comes with all of that. So it's not going to be like the Chicago School in Chile. It's not going to be you. It's not going to be me who is going to be talking about how the Iranian economy is going to run from there on in. It's going to be a bunch of toady socialists and hyper-leftists and social engineers, and they're going to have to set up all of their crazy lefty, wokey, whatever, right? And so that's the challenge. And then, you know, you still have a fundamentalist religious group that's going to rebel against that, and you're just going to set up. So it's not just a matter of taking out the regime, even if that could be achieved relatively peacefully. It is, who gets to rebuild it? Well, it's not going to be Dr. Block. I mean, I think it'd be great if it was. It's not going to be you. I think it'd be great if it was. I don't think I'd want that power. But it is, who gets to take over that new country? And it is going to be bureaucrats, and it's going to be leftists, and it's going to be socialists, and it's going to be bureaucrats, and it's not going to work.
I agree. And actually, that's something I hadn't addressed yet, was just who does take over. My understanding, there is, you know, there people have thrown around the Pahlavi, you know, the son of the Shah or the grandson of the Shah. I wouldn't necessarily support that. You could argue, oh, well, the Iranian people decide. Well, you know, like you said, it could be a socialist or whoever. Who do they vote in? From my speaking to with Iranians, and I have, you know, half a dozen Iranians I speak to, many they live in Turkey because they left Iran to get to Turkey. They tell me, you know, Iran is largely, like, Persians are largely secular. The majority of the population, even Shia Muslims, which are the majority, they're largely secular. They're not very religious. And they've told me that, yeah, when back in like 79, when they took over, they didn't think it'd be this bad. Like, this would be what the outcome. So I think again, based on their word, anecdotal, the overwhelming majority of Iranians do not support this, or do not support the regime. And what they wanted in this war is kind of, you know, overthrow the regime, but with the least amount of casualties as possible and the least amount of damage as well. And in terms of who takes over, you know, that is a good question. And I do think that, you know, this comes into the question of power. Is the U.S. responsible with its power? Throughout history, it has not been, at least since 45. But I would argue Trump, to a degree, has been more responsible than, I'm not saying trust Trump, but I think he would be more trustworthy than some to help choose a successor. I really do. And I could be totally wrong. It could totally backfire. But I, if he was involved, I think he would help pick somebody that's good. I don't like putting that much trust in one person. I am totally anti-centralized power. And I always think at all times we need to chuck on power. But it's okay. So then it's okay. So we have this situation we have now with the theocratic Islamic dictatorship, whatever. And then it's okay. We overthrow them. Typically, it could be a military dictatorship that you mentioned is socialist. Is there a way we could prevent that? Yeah, I would argue that the U.S. military of some kind would have to combine with the Iranian people to put in place somebody.
But even if you were to put in some sort of system like is in America at the moment, right? Not maybe necessarily some perfect 19th century Jeffersonian democracy, but just something like America has at the moment. Okay, great. So then you get hyperfeminism, you get DEI, you get quota systems, you get everybody suing everybody. And of course, we all know, if you can look at this, the difference between North and South Korea. North Korea, horrendous open-air human prison that it is, has a above replacement birth rate. South Korea is less than one. I mean, South Korea is going to be gone in a generation or two in terms of any viable, sustainable system. And that's also a concern, which is, and again, I'm not saying it's better the way that it is, but you're going to go in there and you're going to get all the feminists are going to be, we've got to liberate the women of Iran, which means that there's going to be laws that you have to hire women, which is going to take them out of reproductive roles. And, you know, you're going to have all of this lefty socialistic quota system intervention. Women are going to go to get educated, which is fine. I have no problem. Obviously, no problem. I have a lovely daughter and a lovely wife, and no problem with women getting educated. But I don't like all of the propping up of women in the workforce where you have to hire them or you get sued and so on. I think that's terrible because of violation of freedom of association. And so that's another sort of question is, let's say that you can somehow take out the existing system and then you replace it with the kind of system that's going on in Europe or America. Well, then you're going to end up with the collapse of the birth rate, and then there's going to be more frantic panicking, and then they're going to say, well, you know, at least under the mullahs, we were sustainable as a society. And I don't know. I mean, so even if somehow America were to replace the Iranian system with something like itself, it's hard to know how that would be particularly sustainable. And the one last point I wanted to make was, I will believe in America saying Iran is a terrible risk. I will believe that when they stop taking hundreds of thousands of Iranians as immigrants. I mean, this to me, like, if you're going to say, oh, it's death, America, the great Satan, and so on, then you can't allow immigration from that country. Say, oh, yes, but it's only the good one. You can't tell, right? There'd be nobody. And to me, it would be like England in 1941 taking 50,000 fighting-age German men coming into the country. No, we're all anti-Nazi. Well, that's exactly what the Nazis would say, right? We're all anti. And so that is, to me, I don't care about what people say too much. I'm an empiricist, so I care about what they do. America clearly doesn't see Iran as much of a threat. Otherwise, it would not allow, I think there's close to 500,000 immigrants from Iran in America just since the 70s. And I'm not even saying that's that big a problem. But what it does tell you is that the American government does not consider Iran really much of a threat at all.
Sure, sure. Well, yeah, responding to the Iranians in the U.S. first, I don't, you know, just pushing back on my anecdotal experience, a lot of the Iranians I've met, they're both Christian and Jewish. I've met some Muslim Iranians, you know, they're pretty pro-America. I mean, unless they're being dishonest to me, they're pretty relatively pro-America. Again, like you said, there's 500,000. I have not spoken to all 500,000. I don't know what their opinions are or they're to be concerned about, but my interactions totally have been positive with Iranians in the U.S. Again, could be wrong, you know, who knows, but that's my interactions with them. As for, you can feel free to respond, otherwise I'll jump onto the
I also have had lovely interactions with Iranians in the West. It just tells me that if the gateway is open to mostly unvetted people from Iran, that America does not consider Iran a massive threat. Like America says that China is a massive threat, but then they join forces to do gain of function research in Wuhan. Therefore, they don't consider China to be that much of a threat. I'm concerned about this sort of threat narrative being used to justify a war or further violations of the non-aggression principle. And, you know, it's like to take a silly example, it's like, you know, the woman you know who says, my boyfriend is just the worst guy ever. He's terrible. It's like, well, why do you keep going back to him? It's like, you can't think he's that terrible if you keep going back to him. And it can't be that much of a threat. Either China, at least it's not perceived. I think it may be China for sure, more than Iran. But it's just, and sure, you meet and I meet people who are very nice from China and from Iran, but there's no way in particular to tell ahead of time, certainly not at the government level, who's safe and who's not. And if your doors are open to infinite numbers of people, pretty much from a country you consider to be an extremely dangerous enemy that's willing to use weapons of mass destruction, then both of those things can't be true.
Yeah, and it's her point. You know, I need to look into it more of just, you know, the demographics of the Iranian immigrants. I don't, you know, to my perspective, Persians are very high achieving. I think they're doing quite well in the United States. I just would be rather shocked, even the, say, Shia Muslim ones that are coming in, if they're like, you know, kind of a fifth column, if you will. I'm not saying that none of them are. I'm sure some of them are, you know, have horrible resentment towards the U.S. government, and rightfully so for the things we've talked about earlier, where the U.S. has intervened unjustifiably, perhaps in Iran and everything like that. I wonder, like, you know, how many. So in terms of like vetting, it's a good question. Like the term vetting, you mentioned they're unvetted. I'm sure some of them have come over the southern border and just got through and, you know, whatever. I do wonder, you know, in terms of legally immigrating to the United States, how many of them are just, you know, totally resentful and want the destruction of the U.S.? I don't know. My interactions with them have been totally positive, and I haven't read about, I don't know, some Iranian coming to the United States trying to blow up Times Square or something. Maybe there have. Maybe I'm being ignorant, but
well,
I don't
I'm sorry to interrupt. And I agree with all of that. And again, my experiences with Iranians have been very positive. But if there is a virtual state of war between the two countries, you simply wouldn't do it. Again, I mean, lots of Germans would love to have left Germany under the Nazi regime and fled to England, maybe even would have fought with England, but you couldn't allow that in a state of war. You just couldn't allow, you know, 50 or 100,000 young men in particular coming across from a country you're currently at war with. Like, that would be kind of inconceivable. So it's not to me to say that there's anything wrong or negative with Iranian immigrants. Again, my experience has been very much the same as yours, although I wouldn't move in radicalized circles anyway, so I can't really judge that. But fair I'm point. Just saying you can't have the narrative of we welcome all the people from this country and they wish to nuke us. Like, you can't have both.
Fair point. And yeah, I agree. I don't go in the jihadi circles either. So maybe there are some that are in those circles that want to destroy America. And then on to the other point. Actually, I forgot your previous point. I got so into the immigration point. I know you made another point about the Iranian government, and I know replacing it. Yeah, look, that is probably the biggest challenge.
Oh, this was the argument that you get sort of hyper-socialist feminism coming in that kills the birth rate, and that's, you know, that's been what you sacrificed everything for.
Fair, yeah, and I agree. But and maybe this is naivete, I don't know if the Persians, the ones I've chatted with and talked to, they don't seem very like woke. They don't seem really into all that. And the women, and I know a lot of women, I don't know if they're very into the, again,
but the woke is why the revolution succeeded. Like the leftists, as so often, the leftists and the theological radicals all joined forces to I'm sure you've seen those pictures, terrible picture of these two Iranian women cheering the 79 revolution. And one of them was killed. The other one had to flee to Sweden and so on. So, how long does it take for that mind virus to take hold if it's funded, if it's in the educational system, if it's everywhere in the media and so on, which generally tends to happen with these kinds of situations? So it's true that they're not particularly woke, but it was the combination of the hard leftists and the religious fundamentalists who produced the 79 revolution. And so it's there's no massive genetic human immunity to this kind of mind virus. And I think given the way that American education and most of Western education is going at the moment, I think it's pretty hard to imagine how it wouldn't find its way into the minds of Iranians. And of course, if it starts when they're 5 years old, it's pretty tough to kick that habit.
And I think that's entirely possible. My experience, and I've traveled a lot, by the way, in the world, this is something we could get into, is in the world of remote work. Now, I don't have to sit there in Manhattan now and step over a body of a guy injecting a needle into himself, some homeless guy, and go into the office anymore. I can go live in Turkey, or I can live in South America and work remotely and whatever. So I could work in a place like Turkey or something. And meeting these people, I met a feminist, someone who was self-described as a feminist in Turkey. And all she said was, you know, I want equal rights, which could be a number of things. But my argument is, certainly in these developing countries, I don't know if feminism is my experience, feminism is not the same thing over there as it is here. Here, it's, you know, everything you said is what it is. Over there, I wonder, because they've had it tougher. It's certainly in South America. I know South America is different than Iran. The women I've met in South America, and they say, oh, I'm a feminist, and for whatever. And all they want, so one woman or a couple of women have talked to me and said, they just want abortion legalized in the case of rape or incest or life of the mother. Because in many of those countries, it's totally illegal. Even if you're going to die, the woman can't get an abortion. So, which, by the way, we can debate whether we agree with it or not. I can go into all that.
No, I don't agree with abortion. I don't agree with banning abortion if the mother's going to die.
Yeah,
but anyway, go ahead.
Fair enough. No, I was just saying, I do think there would be a push. I agree with you that the West, if let's say Iran became a Western kind of democracy, I know the feminist movement in the U.S. or in the Western Europe would shove in and try and shove their opinions down their throats. And maybe I'm being naive and saying, I hope there would be a pushback, or they'd be like, wow, it would just be, I think to a lot of them, it'd be very foreign. I'd be rather shocked, I would say, if they totally adapted it full hand. But I agree, that is a risk. It is an absolute risk. I think it's a better problem to have than the one they have. That would be my ultimate argument then on that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Listen, I think we've had a good old chat. Is there? And I really do appreciate the conversation. I really do love the friction of differing ideas and arguments. And I don't want to sound kind of, you did a great job, but no, it was really, really enjoyable conversation. Is there anything that you want to mention? Have you got a website or other things that you wanted to mention to my audience before we close the conversation? Yeah.
Well, first, I just want to thank you. You are the man. I can't thank you enough for having me. And thanks for giving me all the time to respond and everything. And I know we don't necessarily fully agree on this, but I think we agree on more than we think we do. Or, you know, maybe before you thought, you know, whatever. But we have a lot of agreements. And I agree with a lot of your pushback, by the way. And I can't thank you enough for having me on. I really appreciate the, you know, this is totally positive and everything. A very constructive debate. And I do have criticisms about the Libertarian Party that I kind of brought up about the, you know, all or nothing, that, you know, hopefully you and I could have another chat. I have another article coming out with Walter Block. I'll send it to you. If you want to have me back on, I'd love to come back on.
It was a very enjoyable conversation. I think it's also really nice for people to see people who disagree and can have a positive and productive conversation. I mean, that's win-win, right? And it's the audience to decide whose arguments win out in the long run. But yeah, there's no reason for people to get mean and hostile or negative or anything like that. I mean, we're all wanting a better world. And certainly you and I would overlap on 99% of the of our beliefs, and the 1% is where the most interesting conversations are. So I really do appreciate you dropping by.
Absolutely, and I'll let Walter Block. If you want Walter on, I'm sure he'll happily come on. If you want to chat with him about whatever,
yeah, this that would be something. Great. Keep me posted and stay in touch.
Absolutely, and Tom's of X, just follow me on X/JamesDelmer1 if anybody wants to.
We will put the link in, and you have a website too.
Yes, jamesdelmer.com.
Okay, we'll add that to the show notes and well worth looking at. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, it mainly covers cryptocurrency stuff, but, you know, I'll be adding more in the blog, but more on my Substack and everything, but it's growing as we speak.
Yeah, and my audience is not unfamiliar with the crypto world, so I would definitely recommend checking out James's show and James's website, and we'll put your X handle on here. Really appreciate your time today. Have yourself a great afternoon.
You too, Stefan. You're the man. Thank you so much. Hopefully I see you again soon.